Well, good morning, everybody. It's a great pleasure to be here and a great privilege to be invited to come and speak at this particular event. Please excuse me as I'm speaking. I'm used to having, you know, a nice little microphone around my neck. I keep thinking I've got either my little baby daughter or a large ice cream in front of me here. So if I start to eat the ice cream, please somebody warn me. My name is Simon Levin. I'm a research director with the Gartner Group. And for those of you not familiar with Gartner, we're the world's largest research and advisory services company. We have about 400 analysts worldwide, and that's the end of the plug for Gartner Group. So that's just a little bit about who we are. I actually work in the personal computing service at Gartner and work out of our European research headquarters, which is actually in the UK, and almost right next to the runway next to Terminal 4 at Heathrow. So for those of you who fly in, about the last building you see as you're landing is the Gartner Group building. So you may remember us the next time you travel. As I mentioned, I work in the PC service, in the PC area, and this has to be one of the most exciting areas of the industry to be involved in. I mean, it's fascinating. Here is an industry where, you know, if you took, you may have heard this analogy, but if you took the pace of change of the PC industry and you applied that to, say, the automobile industry, then over the last 20 years, you would find now today that you could buy an automobile for less than $5 and it would do over 100,000 kilometers for every liter of petrol you put in. That has been the pace of change of this industry. Indeed, you know, if you look at this from a metric position, then computing power today costs less than 1/100th of 1% of what it did just some 20 years ago. It's phenomenal change. And this change is continuing to happen at an accelerating pace. So what I'm going to talk about through this session is we're going to talk about the environment of end-user computing. I'm going to talk about issues such as network computers and net PCs and PCs and where's this going. We're going to talk about operating systems. I'm going to talk about the user computing environment in the future and how that will impact the end user. I'm going to talk about managing that environment, about total cost of ownership and other vehicles, management vehicles for trying to get a control of the user computing infrastructure. Now, to do this, I'm going to approach this by covering what we call three key issues. And key issues are really key questions that we see organizations asking themselves about what they need to do to move forward in technology over the next 5 years. And this is a scenario outlook, a five-year outlook on where the technology is going. So the three key issues that I'll be looking at will firstly start with a number of key trends. And specifically, I'll focus in there on how the role of technology is changing, how businesses are starting to actually be shaped by technology, as opposed to reacting, or technology reacting, rather, to the direction of the business. Secondly, as I look ahead at this kind of brave new world, one of the things that we'll see in there as we look at all these technology changes is that one thing that is most definitely not happening is that the environment is consolidating. Quite the opposite. The world of the desktop is increasing in diversity significantly. Now, on the one hand, this is a huge challenge. On the other, let me sell this to you as a great opportunity. Because what we're going to see is the ability in the future to far more closely match what users are trying to do and what technology exists to enable them to do that. And then finally, the third issue I'll look at, we'll look at how, as this world gets more complex, how, as this world gets more diverse, as we find new ways to exploit the diversity of technology, how could it be remotely possible in that kind of environment to increase the functionality that we're giving people and at the same time manage down the costs of the infrastructure we're creating? What we'll see as we go through here is that this is all fundamentally a question of balance. It's a balance between clients and servers. It's a balance between users and IS professionals. It's a balance between the short term and the long term. So let's start off with the first of the key issues, and this is really an issue about trends, about the relationship between technologies and businesses in the organizations that we work in. If you look at the standard application environment, the implementation of that technology in businesses, and you look back into the past at how we've applied technology, then there's always been a simple rule that we followed. We've continually done the same thing, only better, only faster, only more efficiently. Take the transition from, you know, sending a letter to somebody to, oh, well, now I can send that as a telex, I can make a phone call, I can send it as a fax, I can do that as an email. I've made ways of making this faster and faster and more efficient. But still, I'm fundamentally doing the same thing. I'm sending a message. And organizations haven't fundamentally changed as a result of that. However, we're at a point in the industry, a point in the world today, which is a fundamental turning point. We're starting to see new technologies, such as knowledge management, collaborative technologies, even basic things such as the hyperlinking of content. These are enabling us to do things that we fundamentally could not do before. Organizations will take their advantage in future, will push the boundaries in future by working in different ways, by exploiting the technology. And we refer to organizations in this kind of frame as either computing or technology-defined enterprises. Now, a technology-defined enterprise could be a whole organization. We're starting to see this in many cases as a spin-off from an existing organization. It could even be a department within one particular enterprise. Indeed, to be a technology-defined enterprise, all I actually need is a server, a phone line, and an internet service provider. And I can set myself up and establish myself as a technology-defined enterprise. We're seeing whole new organizations emerging on the back of this. If we take one example as just one single instance, for example, Amazon Bookshop, who you may have seen on the World Wide Web, is a virtual bookshop with over 1 million books, far more than any bookshop you could ever see. You can go in the bookshop and they can advise you on the different books. You can provide a profile and find books that would be of interest to you because of your particular area of expertise. Something that just can't happen in a real bookshop. It's a technology-defined enterprise. Now, this is going to change the world that we operate in fundamental ways. And one example of this, one instance of this, is empowerment of the individual, enabling far closer ties to be created between the people we have in our organization and the partners that we may be working with. And a technology that is enabling that, one technology impact of this, is the growth of what we call the location-independent type of user. Now, let me just very quickly explain what I mean by location dependence and independence. Somebody who is location dependent is somebody who always works either over here in London or perhaps always works over here in Berlin. But I always work in fixed locations. Somebody who is location independent, well, if you want an example of somebody who's location independent, here I am. I work all around the world. I work on planes and trains, in the back of cars and taxis. Wherever I may be, that has to be my office. I am a true location-independent worker. And what we're starting to see is that from a position today where about 20% of users on average in any kind of organization are truly location-independent types of workers, by 2001, 2002, that will be in excess of 40% of people in the organization. Why? Why? Why not? Why are we location dependent? What on earth has that got to do with what we're actually doing in our lives? It has very little. It's all down to the need in the past to be able to access specific resources that required us to be in a specific location. But the world doesn't look like that anymore. And so behind this, we start to see a fundamental growth in the use of mobile technologies and a fundamental growth in that as a segment of the world that we're operating in. And I'll talk more about the kind of technologies as we go through here. But just think about this a little further. Because where you may have users today who are connected to your network to work with the different applications that you're providing, as you move into the future, what if a large percentage of those people are only occasionally connected? What are the implications for the support you need to give these people? What are the implications about applications? I mean, what happens if I run behind a machine and I cut the wire? Does the application work anymore? When the world is populated by a far greater percentage of these location-independent people, will your environment be supportable? Will it work in any way anymore? Now, if we go back to the overall question of user empowerment, and you go back to the PC revolution, you know, I'm not going to teach you a history lesson. We all know the PC revolution was about user empowerment. It was about users wanting to build solutions to problems that we had. And the tools that we started to go out and buy were things like 123 to create models. We bought word processors to be able to create documents. But to be able to get hold of those things, we also, by the way, had to get some hardware and some operating systems. We became little mini data centers as users. Users had to take responsibility for updating and maintaining the environment that they had. And guess what? You know, we suddenly find when we look back on that world and the way that we work, boy, is that an expensive way of doing things. What an incredibly expensive way of doing things. And so suddenly now we're starting to see, you know, around the whole industry, the pendulum swinging. We moved from that mainframe world to the PC world to give users functionality, and we lost control. And now suddenly we're seeing the pendulum trying to swing back again, back towards manageability, back towards control of costs. The definition of user empowerment is set to change. The distribution and responsibilities of ownership of the technologies we have around the organization are set to change. How? Well, you know, as we look ahead, the desire of users for what they're looking for from a user computing environment do not fundamentally change. Users want solutions. It's the enablement of that empowerment to build those solutions. That's what changes. Basically, users don't want the baggage. Now, as users, we don't want to have ownership of the hardware and the network infrastructure and all the APIs and the servers. It's not necessary to do the tasks that we're actually trying to achieve. What users do want is easy and immediate access to information. They want seamless communication and collaboration. That's what you're looking for. Looking for the ability to support tasks with truly the most effective and appropriate tools. And so as we see this pendulum swinging, it can't be the whole pendulum that swings. We don't want to go back in time. Sure, what we're looking to try and do, and most organizations are looking to try and do, is hand the infrastructure back to some central group who manage the IS infrastructure, the PCs, the services, the networks, the servers, the APIs. We need to put an IS group responsible for not just things like data administration and database administration, but in the future, responsibility for repositories, for pools of content, as well as data, as well as sets of business rules. IS start to provide an environment of encapsulated process and content that users can build from. We start to enter into the world of beans building, using technologies such as Java Beans or using ActiveX's. We start to see things like the Beans machine from IBM. We start to see similar technologies emerging from organizations like Sun. These are just one example of how the user infrastructure may appear. User empowerment is coming from access to data and those services. The user environment then becomes built of a browser to view the information and knowledge we have, and an editor to assemble the content and to assemble the processes we need for those solutions. So how does this appear as an overall environment for the user? How does the user experience change overall? Well, to try and explain that to you, to try and give you a picture of the user experience, let me tell you a little story. And this actually relates back to a conference I was attending, I guess it was last year. And it was in the United States. And I was traveling back on the plane and got on board and started chatting to the guy next to me and explained to him that I was in the IT industry, which is a bit like telling somebody you're a doctor. You know, immediately they start telling, oh, you know, I've got a problem with my elbow or my ear, you know, I've got a headache. You know, but in the IT industry, they start to tell you about their PC problems. Now, the person sitting next to me was a lawyer, and he started to tell me about how he was buying for himself a brand new mobile PC with voice recognition capabilities, and it was really expensive, and he was really pleased for himself. Interesting. So I asked him, well, why are you doing this? Why are you buying this technology? And what he said to me was, well, you know, I already have a PC in the office on which I do word processing. But you know what happens? I start doing some word processing on that machine, and I'm typing something in, and suddenly, all by itself, the text moves itself to the right. So what's this guy thinking? He's thinking he's going to sit down with his mobile PC with voice recognition, and when it does exactly the same thing, he's going to say, "No! Move it back to the left." Okay, it's an interesting concept, but do you know this guy had a really serious point behind that? Why is it he has to understand the technology? We've reached a point where we have the power in this kind of hardware for the user to not have to understand the technology. It is about time that the technology started to understand what it is the user's trying to do. Why can't it understand, no, move it back to the right? It is a perfectly reasonable expectation. And so we move from a world which was totally disconnected, where we hadn't even a common operating system just some 25 years ago, to a world today that is built around document-centric computing, around the intranet, around groupware, where we have collaboration, but that collaboration is still fundamentally asynchronous. As we move forward, we start to see a world in task and job-centric computing where networks become completely transparent to the user. I don't have to worry about where things are. Collaboration becomes synchronous through things like NetMeeting and chat technologies. Users cease to own the technology. What they start to own is their individual knowledge space. That is what is significant to the user. It's that that empowers them, the ownership of that space. And the result of that, it's that that enables the user to become far more completely immersed and involved in whatever project that they're participating in. Organizational structures will change as a result of this, because PCs cease in the future in organizations and most organizations to be some kind of support device, to be some kind of office support device. PCs are becoming virtual offices. Wherever I access my system image, I can gain access to all of the services that I need that relate to my individual office environment. Now, one of the technologies that is clearly enabling this and driving this is the internet. And to try and understand the impact of this, I put together just one slide from a survey I undertook in Europe last year, covering about 500,000 desktops and 130 different organizations, about how quickly those organizations would have access to internet and would have access available to their users to internal intranets. And what we saw there was from a base today of 80% of those organizations, or 80% of users rather in those organizations, today being able to access local area networks, we see not surprisingly by the end of 2000, 80% of users across organizations being able to access intranets. One leads to the other. We're starting to see a technology change that isn't a fundamental shift, isn't something that I have to reach out to get hold of. It's something that layers on top of the technologies we're already familiar with and users are already familiar with working with. So let's move on to the second issue. And this really takes a look at, you know, as we see this role of computing changing, how will the platform itself react to this? And how will the platform evolve? Let's get into some of those issues about the technology. So, as software changes, as the role of software changes, of course, so too does that of hardware. And most particularly here, you know, one thing that has just completely changed and is changing more rapidly in the future is the idea that we had in the past that you could buy one technology that did everything. You remember the days, you know, where we used to buy a personal computer like this one, and when you had it sideways, we called it a desktop. And when we flipped it on its side, we called it a server. And when we stuck a handle on that, that was called a portable. You know, that wasn't that long ago. And yet now today we have fundamentally different technology sets for mobiles, for desktops, for servers. When I bought my first home PC, it was just like the office PC, only it wasn't quite so powerful. Now what do we buy at home? We buy the most powerful machines you can buy, far more powerful than we use when we go into work. We have technologies in there that are way ahead of anything we use in our office environment. The business PC and the consumer PC are just not the same thing anymore. We have different technologies for the user who's permanently connected to the user who's only occasionally connected. You know, the bottom line of this is that users, as it turns out, you know, funnily enough, are not all the same. We don't all need the same thing. We're not all looking for the same set of functionality. As an example, we have users who range from just needing to be able to run business processes that are defined for them. That's all they're doing. Running a set of tests, perhaps, that we've established. Through to users who are actively involved in the creation of rich media content. And so as we start to rebalance client and server processes, we're starting to introduce a range of alternative architectures and configurations. On the desktop, everything from terminals through to full function workstations, mobiles, personal digital assistants, web phones, intelligent pages, through to complete full function desktop equivalent notebooks. Servers are moving from the standard file and print, one box, one design. We're starting to see more and more specialized design for web servers, for mail servers, for database servers, for messaging servers, as well as, you know, good old file and print. Today in this world, you know, we live in a market that is absolutely dominated by hype. Boy. Claim versus counterclaim. NC versus PC versus NetPC. I mean, which one wins? Should you really care? Which one wins? Because, you know, when you come back to it and you think about what's going on here, let's point at one first market reality. These things are not that different. What they are all points on a single continuum. And we refer to that continuum as network computing devices, NCDs. To be an NCD, a device does not have to be diskless. You know, it doesn't have to rely on the World Wide Web. It doesn't have to only offer remote execution as the only means of working. You know, these are nonsenses put about by vendors in the technology marketplace. To be an NCD, a technology has to be able to exploit the network environment it's connected to. And so as we look at the choices here, what we'll see is you're constantly playing a balancing game as you choose between the technologies that emerge. There's a balance of manageability. That's one axis we see on here. Functionality, the flexibility we give to our users. Network bandwidth. You know, how much can we have that's server processed? How much can we have that's client processed? How much can we have that's traveling between? And the performance levels that we need to provide users. And so we see different points on the continuum offering different sets of options. Terminals, so-called network computers. The pure network computers offer high manageability and low functionality, while at the other end we have workstations offering high functionality but highly reduced manageability. And in between, a whole host of options that are just starting to emerge. Network computers with disks. Yes, it will happen. With flash memory, of course it's going to happen. NCs running with emulation for Windows, whether that's something like Insignia or something like the ICA protocol for Citrix. Citrix boxes, individual clients just running that Citrix protocol to provide NT-type capabilities, but pure remote execution. We'll see sealed box PCs running standard operating systems, but where the user can't get in and change things. These are all just some of the options that we're starting to see today. We'll see a whole raft of new options emerging on that continuum, providing new choices on that continuum as vendors start to mature the technology sets. So the key question then isn't, you know, which one of these wins? Because none of them win. We'll see all of them play a part in the environment. The key question is, where is each one of these most appropriate in your organization for which groups of users, for which sets of tasks? Because you should expect them to coexist in the future. Now, at the end of the day, there is no one technology solution out of these that will be perfect for everyone. That's the whole driving force behind this change. The future won't be characterized by a switch in the devices we use. It will be characterized by an increase in the overall volume that we use and the diversity of devices. Today, this is being driven by a peak of hype in the market right now around the ideas of manageability, around the ideas of cost of ownership, something we'll talk about later. Now, as I'm sure you're all familiar with, this hype is not something that's unique in the IT industry. Never have I seen a world, you know, there is no world of greater hype than the IT industry. There's no world where there are more unmet expectations of users. There is no world where there are more spectacular successes and more spectacular failures than the IT industry. Nowhere are there as many disillusioned and dissatisfied users. I mean, any other industry, you know, the companies playing in there would have gone out of business. The IT industry is characterized by rapid cycles of inflated technology expectations. You know, it could do everything you ever imagined. The hype is created with almost reckless abandon by vendors. You know, they really don't seem to take into account at all the maturity or immaturity of the technology they're hyping. It just gets pushed into the market and we have to deal with it. And of course, what happens as you start to see that? You know, reality sinks in and we move from a peak of hype with any technology to something we call the trough of disillusionment. Oh my God, really, it doesn't do all of those things. It really isn't everything that the market hyped it up to be. And from that point, we move on to something we call the slope of enlightenment. And this is true of any technology that you map. We reach a point where we understand where this really fits. Now, why am I showing this to you? I'm showing this to you to suggest to you that when you look at any technology, NCs, net PCs, or any other technology, you should always try and understand where they fit in this kind of a hype cycle. Because you should be looking to buy at the slope of enlightenment. That's where you get real value. Those organizations who buy at the peak of hype, I would suggest to you there are only two types of company or two types of organization who buy at the peak of the hype cycle. Number one, organizations who can identify a very rapid return on investment on introducing a new technology, recognizing that that technology may be extinct within 12 months and may need replacing. And the second group who buy at the peak of the hype cycle, those are the people who get seriously burnt by buying the technology. So when will any of this technology actually be applicable? Well, the reality is over the next 5 years, this is a maturing set of technologies, but today it's highly immature. And so as you start to look at each of the alternatives, you know, you need to think about the technical maturity of each technology. You need to take a look at the availability of tools in that environment and how mature are those? Because in the world of Java today, Java is highly immature and the tools are even more immature. What skills are available if you need skills externally to support you? What software products are available on those platforms, particularly for creation of content? And how does performance appear when you start to implement those technologies? Now, today we're starting to see, of course, a number of organizations implementing what we refer to here as NCS, which is NCs that are server-centric, and what we're referring to here are things like the ICA protocol and Citrix. People who are using that for remote presentation of NT-type applications. NCC is the client NC. This is like the Java station. And where do these start to become applicable? Well, we start to see these becoming applicable now, really, for organizations who are looking to implement a specific business application and just provide a terminal for that business application to users. But are these applicable today as content creation devices? Is this a rich knowledge management content creation environment? Are the technologies there to allow that to happen? Absolutely not. And probably not until at least some way past the year 2000. Are things like, if we look at the productivity world, tools like JOffice, realistic replacements for the desktop productivity tools we work with today? No, they're not. They are proofs of concept that we can start to work on these things, but it is not a replacement environment. So the net of all of this, well, if you take two fundamental directions of technology, you take the world coming from the traditional PC, and you take the world coming from the traditional NC, and understand that they're all moving in the same direction. NCs are adding hard disks and the ability to client process. PCs are starting to move in the direction of allowing more to happen on the server rather than everything client process. But if you take those two technology strands, then we believe through the year 2001, 20% or less of the clients that will be implemented globally will come from the NC direction. 80% or more will come from the PC direction, PCs or net PCs. Because users will require more in terms of functionality in creation of content as users become far more involved in the overall application process, as they become far more involved in whatever projects they're associated with. So they need a richer tool set. So we create a whole new set of knowledge workers who will not get sufficient functionality from the thinner style device in that time period. The world is changing. It's changing rapidly. But are there any parts of this that we can possibly see as constants in the world that we work in? Well, let me give you one constant that you can take comfort in. You will in the future be able to continue signing checks to Mr. B. Gates of Redmond, Washington. That's something you can be sure of, alongside death and taxes as certainties. If we go back and look behind here, you know, at the battle for the desktop, for desktop environments and operating systems, then, you know, this isn't something that's over. It's still being fought. There are old players, there are new players. The old players, people like Macintosh and OS2, let's be honest now. These players have been forced back into a niche in the market. Macintosh, for graphics processing, for creation of content, media publishing. This is really where the Mac has some future. OS2 being pushed back in corporate organizations to people who've implemented it for robust client-server type applications. But predominantly, the world today has moved down the Microsoft track. That's where the momentum has been. That's where the applications have been, the support from ISVs. But now as we move forward, the spotlight is changing. The old contenders drifting back into the distance, and new contenders are appearing in the market. New contenders from a wholly different environment. They didn't play in the desktop before. People who are driven by a competitive desire to unseat Bill Gates and Microsoft. They're desperate to get into that client environment and to have some control at that level. And the route that they've taken for that, the message they've taken for that, has really struck a chord with people. You know, this whole issue about NCs has really struck a chord. The idea, the promise that you'll be able to manage desktops more effectively, be able to manage the asset, manage the life cycle, maybe even manage the users. It's been a hit. But does it make them a winner? We don't think so. Sure, it gives them an entry in the market, but the competitor they're playing against is a fearsome foe. They're a nimble organization for someone so big. Microsoft's modus operandi can best be described as embrace and extend, or it can actually be better described as engulf and devour. Because what do? They saw the threat, and they've been nimble to address that. They've been nimble to address the internet. Zero administration windows. Okay, let's ignore the idea of zero administration because that's complete nonsense. But what we do see behind there is an ability in the future to make a manageable desktop. Absolutely. The zero administration kit. Okay, we can't get zero administration windows out until NT5. Zero administration kit. Buy it today. Apply it to NT. Apply it to Windows 95. Make the platform more manageable. Reduce the costs of working with it. Net PCs, Windows terminals. Support for Java. You know, Microsoft, the company that would have nothing to do with Java, now probably the company with the highest performant Java virtual machine. They are nimble to react. And so we expect in the future that Microsoft will maintain dominance in this core space by co-opting technologies as they need to. But still, that doesn't simplify the diversity completely, because even if the only player were Microsoft, there still isn't only one choice. There's more than one choice. In the 32-bit world, NT and Windows 9X, and add to that potentially Windows CE, which we believe in the future will become a client environment, even in the desktop world, offering an ultra-thin type of client to work with things like a Citrix protocol. And which one of these is the right choice? I mean, are these merging together? Is NT the only choice for an organization that's looking for business type applications or for analysis types of applications? And 9X is really just a consumer technology. Will they just merge together in a couple of years' time, as I often read in the press? Well, the reality here is that we believe Microsoft are playing in two different segments of the market. And those aren't consumer and business. They're high-end and mainstream. There are people like you who tend to want to take the latest technology and take advantage of that. And so that's where NT is aimed. There are people with mainstream desktops who are just running productivity applications, and that's where the 9X line is aimed. They'll have shared technologies. They'll have shared APIs. That's growing with things like the Common Device Driver model that appears in Memphis and NT version 5. But they remain separate technology streams. Certainly, Microsoft's focus is that NT5 will be the platform for corporate-type organizations and businesses. But in the choice in the market today, we have NT4 and Windows 9X. Now, let me just quickly paint a couple of dates on these, by the way. What we refer to as Windows 97 is the product code name Memphis, which I do not believe will ever ship with the name Windows 97. At best, it will ship in the market at the end of this year. And into early next year. NT5 shipping halfway through next year and really going to be viable for implementing on a large scale basis, because this will be an initial version of a new technology set, so really viable at the end of 98, early 1999. In terms of the market today, well, the choice is NT4, which is robust, secure, fully 32-bit. It is new technology, and hence also, it doesn't support a lot of old hardware, it doesn't support a lot of old devices, it doesn't support a lot of old applications, doesn't have plug and play, doesn't have power management, doesn't allow hot swapping of PC cards. It's suitable for business critical types of environments, for highly secure environments, for highly controlled desktops, where users require scalability, where users require smooth multitasking kinds of capabilities. 9X, best support for the legacy world, best support for mobile users, best support for people who are just running a productivity desktop. And oh, by the way, in most cases, in terms of cost of moving from one to another, 9X is something like 30 to 47% less expensive on average than moving to the NT4 platform. So for the last few minutes, let's talk about the final key issue, which is, with all of these changes and this increasing complexity, now how on earth can you start to manage all of that? And if we start with the concept of complexity, then clearly in the past, you know, we've had a trade-off. As we've introduced more functionality, we've taken on board more complexity. And we've accepted that because that's been a reasonable trade-off. It's been better than reducing complexity and taking reduced functionality as the price. But we've reached a point where the market's starting to ask, how much complexity can we possibly handle? When does functionality become overkill? As we start to move forward, we're going to see organizations, vendor organizations, focusing more and more on trying to offer the promise of a world that has decreased complexity and increased functionality. And as you see that being promised to you and offered to you, ask yourself, is that really what's on offer? Can the vendor really do that? Or are they masking complexity with things like additional help? Certainly, we expect to see this continued linear relationship between functionality and complexity continue in the future. And as you try and provide a better environment for users, or you look for a better environment, then realistically, the only way to reduce complexity will be to try and mask it. It's not going to be handled by the technology. It's going to be handled by somebody in the organization digging with a shovel and making things happen that the users don't necessarily see. It's systems management. It's putting in more manageable platforms. Now, one step and strategy that many organizations have taken in the past to try and reduce this complexity has been to try and find a sweet spot to buy into, defined by hardware, operating system, and software. You know, the 286 with DOS and 123 or WordPerfect, or we'll buy 386s with Windows 3 and first generation Office, or 486s with 8 megabytes of memory with third generation Office and Windows 3.x. But that was a thing of the past. This explosion of devices, different device types, it's just going to preclude that from being a strategy in the future. Already today, organizations are struggling with different versions of Windows, different suite versions and styles of suites and productivity tools, different browsers and releases of browsers, and how many different processors from Intel with MMX or without MMX. Which are the right choices to make here? There is no one sweet spot anymore. It's gone. In the future, organizations will have to accept the fact that the environment is becoming more diverse, and it's going to be a case of adjusting to managing multiple technologies and technologies which are actually at different points in their individual life cycles. The approach then has to become instead, as it moves across very slowly, to get ahead, focusing on a suitable management infrastructure to manage this diverse environment. Now, the good news is relief is on the way here. This whole aspect of hype around the NCs has actually woken up the whole IT industry. They've realized that user organizations are worried about costs and they need to address it. And so every vendor worth their salt is rushing in with technologies and tools and features in their product that will help reduce the cost of managing them, make the environment more manageable. Everything from the hardware up through Intel and some of their OEMs starting to put together building blocks for thermal and voltage sensing, for predictive failure capabilities. The Desktop Management Task Force suddenly waking up and introducing with Desktop Management Interface, DMI version 2, an environment that all the vendors are going to embrace, that will enable remote management of the desktop environment. Beyond that, you need to look at basic asset management as a key element of this management stack for managing the environment, the what's and where's. Software asset management, remote access, control, electronic software distribution, help desk, key elements to creating an environment that will allow us to operate in this diverse way. Network systems management, for traffic and performance monitoring, for server management. The fundamental change happening here has to be that as you look at your IT infrastructure in the future, you need to create an environment that is managed or created to manage for and to enable change. Instead of the environment that we have today, which is trying to manage the change that's already happened, it needs to be looking ahead. And why? Well, why is because this is not an option. This is not an optional change. This is critical. Because all the new technologies we've been talking about, as you start to introduce them into the overall infrastructure, are going to mean re-architecting that infrastructure probably at least twice in the next 5 years from top to bottom. And if you're going to do that, if it's going to happen, if you're going to be able to afford it, there has to be a stack in the middle that allows the management for that change. Now, the first step in this has to be an asset management program. Now, if I'm going to change things, I have to know the story. Who, what, when, where, how, why, how much. The basic things. Who's got what? What are they doing with it? Why are they using that particular technology? When did they get it? How did they get it? How much did it cost them? If I don't know that information, I can't plan to introduce more suitable technologies in different areas. I can't address the organization. Asset management is a key enabler. It needs to be a core IT practice. It's the solid foundation for the management stack that I was talking about. What about cost of ownership? Well, cost of ownership is something Gartner started talking about back in 1987-88. We are partly responsible for this hype. I hold my hand up. We've been selling the message that overall cost of desktop computing is more important than purchase price for a very long time. But now this has become a whole industry mantra, cost of ownership, cost of ownership. Every vendor's talking cost of ownership. But it's important when you look at this, you know, look at what's really here. Because I often talk to organizations who say, well, I looked at your cost of ownership figures and you gave this number for cost over 5 years. And you know, when we measured our own, it was different. And it comes as a surprise to them. But it doesn't come as a surprise to me. Because like return on investment, when we calculate cost of ownership figures, we have to use a framework. We have to use a set of assumptions, and that's where our numbers come from. And oh, by the way, is it likely that those are exactly the same assumptions and framework that you would use? Not necessarily. Your costs may be different. Your infrastructure may be different. What's important in cost of ownership is, one, measuring your own with the line items that we have, which explain where costs are, and two, it's understanding the comparatives as we start to see them here. Because look at the kind of numbers that we've got there. Let's take the Windows 95 or the NT number. What you see with that 26% reduction is what we've seen as best practice in organizations who've measured and addressed their cost of ownership. They find they can reduce it by some 26%. And look what happens when they do that. By managing cost of ownership, they bring it to similar levels to where some of these new technologies are likely to emerge as cost of ownership in the future. What do we see here? We see that cost of ownership isn't about magical technical changes. Cost of ownership and managing it is fundamentally an attitude issue. It's attitude to technology and the management infrastructure for that technology. It's about measuring and focusing on reduction. That's what's critical, not waiting for the next panacea around the corner that will solve all the problems for you. And so what can you do to reduce cost of ownership in the environment? Well, step one absolutely is measure it. If you don't measure it in your own organization, you can't address it. If I don't know where it is and what it is, I can't do something about it. Step two, well, let's take three basic, simple things. Number one, vendors. Take advantage of your vendors. Vendors offer a lot of manageability features now and cost of ownership reduction features. Manageability with hardware, just-in-time training with software, pre-configuration from the seller of the technology. These all help to reduce the cost, but yet so many organizations fail to take advantage of those and pay the price. Take advantage of vendors. Second, sourcing. You know, as you look to manage this infrastructure and as it gets more complex and diverse, what skills do you really need in the organization to be effective, to do the projects that you're looking to do? And where will it actually be more effective in the future to use third parties to help in certain areas, to outsource those elements? And thirdly, data center operations. How many users do backups? How many users lose data, lose key information because they don't do backups? How many users are on different software versions because we ask the users to install the software versions themselves, only they never get round to it, and then we can't communicate things? When is that going to end? When that's going to end is when some IS group comes down through the network and makes it happen for the user. That's when it's going to end. When data center operations are brought down onto the desktop, electronic software distribution, backups for users' data, providing common templates for common tasks, acting as a database administrator for the databases that users are building. Overall, reducing cost of ownership is about focusing on where the real costs are. And at the end of the day, you know, costs are broken up into two things. It's capital costs and labor costs. That's all that we spend money on. And at the end of the day, technology costs come down, capital costs reduce over time, and labor costs always go up. So the more money we spend on labor-intensive tasks, the more expensive the environment is. The more you can switch labor-intensive costs into capital costs, the lower the overall cost is. So introducing things like electronic software distribution, asset management technologies, license management, and help desk all help to reduce the overall cost of the environment. Let me put it another way. Three simple rules when you address any area. Categorize, reduce, and simplify. Think of those three things. It's another mantra. Eliminating redundancy, for example, in products, systems, vendors. Yes, we can't have homogeneity overall. It's not going to happen. But where we can bring homogeneity in a single area, that will help to reduce costs. Prioritize and streamline relationships. How many vendors are you working with on different products and technologies, hardware and software and services? And how many do you really need to? Where are the key interrelationships between these vendors and the key interdependencies? Focus on those as the decision point for choosing technologies and partnerships and reducing overall the number of vendor interfaces. Another example, consolidating releases. All those different versions of 1.2.3 and WordPerfect or any other technology that may exist, there's no need for all those different versions. You need to look to try and bring those together. And fundamentally, at the end of the day, if you're planning and trying to plan for long-term cost reduction, it is no use taking a short-term focus. It has to be a long-term focus. It has to be life cycle planning. So in summary, the pace of technology in the PC industry is not slowing down. It's getting faster. And those organizations who will be successful in exploiting that technology in the future will be re-engineering the way that they operate to exploit that kind of technology, taking advantage of the new capabilities that exist, rather than constantly trying to map the technology onto the way that we're structured today. The management focus points of the future will not be the management focus points of today. They are out the window. Focus has to be on planned diversity, on expected diversity. That's where the opportunities will come from. It's planning for change and not planning after change has occurred. Using cost of ownership as a weapon, absolutely, but not forgetting that it is very easy to reduce cost and to reduce benefit and functionality at the same time. You know, that is easy, and that's not something to buy. What you're looking for is at least stable functionality or improved functionality at reduced cost. It has to be a balance of cost and benefit. And finally, now what we're seeing here overall is in this whole mantra of cost of ownership, this whole issue of manageability, is we're seeing a pendulum swing from functionality to manageability. But you need to look as you implement that, and as that is implemented in your organization, that it's not the whole thing that swings. Going back to the past is not the future. It will not bring the benefits that you may think it will. It has to be a balance. That pendulum part moves, and it's identifying which pieces can move and can move back into a centralized management environment and which pieces are truly the empowerment for users. It's defining those and separating those that will create the opportunity as we move ahead. Okay, well, at this point, I've finished the formal part of the presentation. I hope that's been useful and interesting. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to take those.